Kim Stanley Robinson, and Interstellar Dreams, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome to the travel show that takes you to the final frontier. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society, ready this time to make some of you a bit crazy. Kim Stanley Robinson published Aurora last year. It is a sweeping story of interstellar pioneers and an instructive fable illustrating in sometimes tragic detail just how hard it will be to reach the stars. Bill Nye is all in for space, but he questions whether what's needed should be called a renaissance. We begin with the senior editor for the Planetary Society, Emily Lakdawalla. Emily, we've at least mentioned in passing a few times in the past that you're working on a book, and you have an update about that. It's a part of a February 26th blog entry that offers much more, but tell us, what's the status?
When I sat down to write this blog entry, I was sort of chagrined to realize that it was 3 years ago that I had signed the contract to write this book about Curiosity. It's not done yet because I didn't work on it for about 18 months straight because various real life problems intervened. But now I'm back to work on it, and the delay has actually been a very good thing.
I'm not surprised by that. I mean, this mission has made so much progress. I was actually a little concerned that you're going to be writing a book before its time. Now I don't feel that way.
Yeah, there were actually a whole lot of books about Curiosity that came out in the year after it landed. And the thing is that Curiosity didn't really start the science mission on Mars until a year after it landed. By having delayed getting going on writing about the operational part of the mission, I actually get to write about the fun part, which has been happening in the last year or two after it arrived at Mount Sharp and started really doing the stratigraphic science that it set out to Mars to do.
And you have a new title for the book as well.
Yeah, it's not the most catchy title. That's because it's for an academic publisher, Springer Praxis. So the title says exactly what it is, which is Curiosity Rover, Design, Planning, and Field Geology on Mars.
There is no question this is going to have all kinds of great stuff in it. In fact, in this blog entry, you've got these terrific annotated images of the spacecraft that point out all the different parts and components, and you're making interesting discoveries. You mention one of them here. I think it's a great little piece of legacy.
Yeah, this one was a real surprise when I came across it while reading about it. I was trying to understand all the parts of the descent stage, which was the rocket jetpack that lowered Curiosity to the surface, which turns out to have been a spacecraft every bit as complicated as any other spacecraft I've ever seen launched. And it has one part. The propulsion system had this regulator that was actually a used space shuttle part. And now I have another friend, a space blogger, who's going to go research that and try to figure out exactly which shuttle it came from and what missions it flew to before it ended its existence on Mars.
Just great to know that this one little component is up there on Mars now. When can we expect to see this book?
Sometime next year. I'm really going to try to meet my new due date of the end of this year, which means that it'll still need to be edited and everything. So I'd look for it mid-2017.
Between now and then, you've got a lot of work to do on this. So we'll still be seeing blogs, right? And you'll be joining us here on the radio show?
I absolutely will, but my output on the blog will be limited while I'm trying to work on the book.
Understandable and well worth waiting for. Thanks very much, Emily.
Thank you, Matt.
She is, of course, our senior editor, the planetary evangelist for the Planetary Society, a contributing editor to Sky and Telescope magazine, and the author of Curiosity Rover, Design, Planning, and Field Geology on Mars. You can follow the progress of that in her blog as well at planetary.org. I'll be back in a moment with the CEO, Bill Nye, the science guy. Bill, you've been checking the space headlines once again, and it's a source that I love as well.
Oh, Jeff Faust?
Yeah, his first up.
Oh, yeah, I love that. Yeah, so this is, you guys, you have to be into this to read this. but it's about the politics of international relations and how the money changes hands for building rockets, using government funds to build rockets and so on and so on. But two things, Matt. First of all, as we talk, SpaceX had to postpone again, and it may be because there was a ship downrange and they waited an extra, just a couple minutes, and they're trying to get the liquid oxygen super, super cold because then it takes up less volume and you can put more in there and have essentially more rocket fuel in the same sized rocket. And that little delay may be what held things up. It's not clear. They got a helium bubble or something.
Oh.
But it shows you how complicated it is to launch a rocket. On a separate note, A representative in U.S. Congress, Jim Bridenstine, wants to introduce a bill called the American Space Renaissance Act. The notion that you got to have a renaissance of space exploration, to me, speaks to this longing for the Apollo era. Like back in the good old days, we need a renaissance. The good old days, the NASA budget was 10 times what it is today. 10 times.
You think that might be a factor?
Not 10% bigger, 10 times. If I may, 1,000% bigger. And so until people come to grips with increasing the budget even a little bit, and it looks like we're doing that this year, and thinking about the budget in a longer term, the world's largest space agency is still going to wrestle with what to do next. And by the way, in our little business, in the planetary space exploration business, it's not so much about low Earth orbit as about getting big rockets built to go farther and deeper into space. So we're chipping away. But it is an indication, again, of how much people appreciate space exploration. It brings out the best in us. And when you have a robust space program, whether you are the United States, South Korea, or India, all of whom are doing business together now, it advances your society. It brings out the best in your society. It's an exciting time, Matt. It's good to talk with you.
You too, Bill. It's a good time for space, even if it is hard.
Well said.
He's Bill Nye. He's the CEO of the Planetary Society. We go now to Kim Stanley Robinson and a discussion about humans going to the stars or not. Kim Stanley Robinson has won every major and most of the minor awards for creating great science fiction. Red Mars, the first book in his wonderful trilogy about the colonization and terraforming of the Red Planet, is soon to become a major television miniseries. His most recent entirely original novel is Aurora, and it may have stirred up more controversy than anything else he has written. The book is largely a cautionary tale aimed at the starry-eyed dreamers who, like yours truly, may have believed or still believe that interstellar travel is inevitable and must be achieved. But it is so much more than that, as you'll hear in these excerpts from a nearly one-hour conversation I had with Stan a few days ago. Our entire discussion includes consideration of the biological challenges facing interstellar travelers and the self-aware artificial intelligence that is as important as any of the human characters in the book. It's waiting for you in the online version of the show at planetary.org/radio. Aurora contains much tragedy. I look at it ultimately as a triumph, a human triumph, but not at all the sort of triumph you might expect in a book about humankind's magnificent effort to spread itself to other star systems. In fact, as I was reading the book, the phrase that occurred to me very early on in the book was magnificent folly.
I wonder, I hadn't thought of it that way. I'm wondering if it's magnificent, and I do think it may be a folly, but on the other hand, it's humanity has spread over the earth consistently a drive that is strong in us from early on when we left Africa, and 50,000 years later, we were everywhere else on the planet, just walking on foot. So in other words, there's this maybe even genetic urge to look for new territory and spread out. I think it's a question of figuring out when that drive is actually pitched to an impossible place and becomes really some other kind of desire, like for immortality or transcendence, that isn't really appropriate to the project as it's being described.
I see what you mean. So maybe not magnificent folly, certainly not by the protagonist in the book, but maybe some hubris by the people who set them on this course hundreds of years before?
Sure. I think that's valid. I think it will be a kind of a religious quest that going to the stars. For one thing, I think once we truly do put all of the problems on the table and try to solve them, we'll realize in advance that they aren't solvable, so that we may never even try it. So that this book describes is a kind of a thought experiment, saying, well, what if we did? What would be the consequences? And I'm saying in the book that the consequences for the people that we actually send, for the generations that follow in a starship, in a multi-generational starship, would be dreadful, like being born and dying in a debtor's prison in London.
Hmm.
And no matter how nice their material circumstances would be, they would actually be confined in a bad way, and their environment would be breaking down on them. This is a bad fate that you wouldn't have chosen for yourself. So there would be hubris on the part of the people that would decide to do it anyway, like religious fanatics deciding that no matter the price for their own kids, they needed to do something bizarre.
Hmm. The humans that you've populated this ship with have lost touch with much of their own history, not to the degree that Heinlein wrote about in Orphans of the Sky, or it's the other title for that book, Universe, but still they kind of wonder in some ways about their own past, even though they still have science and they know what they're about.
That's right, and I think that it would be different for every person at that point, six generations in. Some people would be scouring the records of the trip itself to try to figure out how they got where they are and what they should do in that moment. They would become historians of the trip with an almost Talmudic intensity. And I didn't really represent any characters like that, but there would be some. And then others are like many people now. What's really important are the people that are right in front of you and the current situation. And whatever happened in the past is really not relevant and not interesting to those people. In the case of the people on this ship, there has been in their past, a couple, few generations back, beyond the memory of anybody alive, there was a trauma. Something bad happened that was frightening enough that seemed to threaten it was an existential threat in the way that people use it now, in that even knowing what had happened might endanger their ability to go forward successfully, so they repressed that memory. They expunged it from the records, and they didn't tell it to their kids, and the AI was complicit in this.
Hmm.
So as they look back at their past, if they do look, some people are going to be able to crack that secret and find out what happened. Others are not. Others weren't interested in the first place. So yes, I tried to have a complicated internal history going on there.
More from Kim Stanley Robinson, author of Aurora, is just ahead. This is Planetary Radio.
This is Robert Picardo. I've been a member of the Planetary Society since my Star Trek Voyager days. You may have even heard me on several episodes of Planetary Radio. Now I'm proud to be the newest member of the Board of Directors. I'll be able to do even more to help the Society achieve its goals for space exploration across our solar system and beyond. You can join me in this exciting quest. The journey starts at planetary.org. I'll see you there.
Do you know what your favorite presidential candidate thinks about space exploration? Hi, I'm Casey Dreyer, the Planetary Society's Director of Space Policy. You can learn that answer, and what all the other candidates think, at planetary.org/election2016. You know what? We could use your help. If you find anything we've missed, you can let us know. It's all at planetary.org/election2016. Thank you.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan, talking today with one of my favorite authors across all genres. Kim Stanley Robinson has already delivered several spoilers regarding his latest novel, Aurora, the story of 2,000 men and women and one artificial intelligence that cross the gulf between stars, only to learn that their intended new home is toxic. Almost incredibly, they decide to begin another epic journey, a return to the green hills of Earth. And I still am so reluctant, even talking to the author, to give away whether they make it. That may become more obvious as we continue this conversation. So you have this hybrid ship that tries to get around the biggest problem here, which is that space is just too damn big. You talk quite a bit, both in the novel, but also in this companion piece that I mentioned in Scientific American, which I highly recommend. People can take a look at it for free online, and we'll provide the link on the show page that you can get to from planetary.org/radio. Well, it really comes down to the old rocket equation. Bring enough fuel to get your ship there, you have to bring even more fuel because you keep increasing the mass of the ship. And I guess you get to this problem of the possibility that there's no Goldilocks option, that it's not that it's too big and not that it's too small. There may be no just right area sort of in the middle between the two of those extremes.
Right. You put it well, because I think what happens is that those two parameters cross each other without ever meeting, so that you don't get a Goldilocks. You get a big empty space. You want the ship as big as possible for ecological reasons, for human reasons, and for the success of your arrival, your inhabitation of the new system. As big as possible. In essence, it would be great to just shoot the Earth there into another planetary system. So the ship should be that big. On the other hand, the bigger it gets, the more fuel to get it going and the more fuel to slow it down. And this is a kind of vicious circle trap where the faster you get it going, the more fuel you need to slow it down. So you want to go very fast to shorten the trip time. You want to go very slow so that you don't have to carry along so much decelerant fuel. So again, you've got parameters that work against each other and perhaps never meet. What you get, I think, is an empty hole in the middle where nothing will work. This is the point that I've been making. And now I want to say, you said this before earlier, I want to pick up on this, for a very long time. Say thousands of years pass and we create a viable permaculture on Earth. Everything's going well, sustainably and stably on Earth. Then say we have inhabited our solar system with successful space stations on all the big planets and planetary moons, everywhere we can do it. And we're out there and we're functioning and we're testing systems. We're seeing what works and what doesn't. We've had some tests of the system of maybe enclosing an asteroid terrarium, as I described them in 2312.
Yeah.
And having something go on in there, like, you know, the Russian cosmonauts in the 1970s, subjecting themselves to horrific isolation just to test things. And you're finding that the system kind of works. And you work out the gigantic amounts of power it would need to push a starship up to speed with a laser push on its back end. In other words, what I'm saying is not that an interplanetary starship is flatly impossible. It's not like faster than light travel. But the difficulties are so extreme that this notion, like there's a 100-year starship group, an advocacy group, there's people talking about doing it as soon as possible, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. They are deceiving themselves as to the difficulties. They're playing a kind of a game, and they're not playing the game with the net up, as some of my colleagues would put it.
Hmm. You also, I mean, in this scenario that you've just painted, we've learned to care for our planet, and we've learned to get the most we can out of our solar neighborhood. You're not a big fan of the argument that says we have to establish a human presence outside our own solar system because we need the plan B, because we may make Earth unlivable.
Oh, that's a terrible thought. No, I hate that idea. I think that kills human support for the space program more than any other thing that the space community says. I always oppose that. It's elitist. It's wrong. It's not taking into account the post-traumatic syndrome. It's not taking into account the notion that we might only stay healthy on Earth itself, that all of these other places are untested, and essentially it's a dream of escape. It's like, oh, my problems are so big, I'm just going to move. It's like, you know, in the 19th century, you could say, my problems are so big, I'm leaving this Europe, I'm going to the New World, and things will be better there. And this is the analogy that people have when they're thinking, well, let's do it on Mars, or let's do it even in another starship system, which is ridiculous because they're not thinking of the distances involved. It's a bad analogy. It's an analogy that is deceptive because everything about it is wrong except for the hope to make things better.
Kim Stanley Robinson is the best-selling author of novels that have won him the big three in science fiction, Hugo's, Nebula's, Locus Awards. His more than 20 books, including the Mars Trilogy that we mentioned a couple of times in this conversation. There's 40 Signs of Rain, a part of another very well-known and wonderful trilogy. Gosh, so many books that I love. The Years of Rice and Salt, fantastic alternate history story. And 2312, to say nothing of Galileo's Dream, which is just a romp. His latest book that we've been talking about is Aurora. Do you want to say anything before we go about Green Earth, which has come out even more recently?
Oh, yes. That trilogy, 40 Signs of Rain, 50 Degrees Below, 60 Days and Counting, I took the opportunity to compress it by about 15%. I edited it down so it would fit into a single volume. It's called Green Earth, and I think that, embarrassing though it might be to confess it, I think the compression did the story a lot of good. I love this new version of it most of all, and prefer it to the longer version. And I'm happy to have it out there. I have a lot to thank Anne Grohl at Random House and Jane Johnson, my editor at HarperCollins UK, for letting me do this. I'd also like to add that, hey, terraforming Mars, I'm still completely on board with it, but the perchlorates in the soil and the apparent lack of nitrogen mean that it's more complicated than we knew when I wrote my Mars trilogy. But these are not stoppers. These are just slower downers or little problems that I trust that we will solve. So in case people are wondering that if I've become a nattering nabob of negativism on everything, no. I still am a great fan of the Mars Project and, you know, hope we get there and as soon as possible.
Thank you for that, Stan. And you know, after all, Earth will still just be a few measly tens of millions of kilometers away.
Next door. Yes.
So, Aurora, the book that we've spent most of our time talking about, was just published last year by Orbit. It's available in all the usual places. Kim Stanley Robinson lives in Davis, California, annoyingly far from the Pacific Ocean that he loves. We're going to visit with another guy who I know has done his share of body surfing. That's my friend Bruce Betts as we go to this week's edition of What's Up. Another week, another What's Up with Bruce Betts on the Skype line. So once again, no JPL gift for you. Maybe next week I'll see you in person and be able to hand it over, but welcome.
But I'm right where I'm supposed to be, in the office and everything.
Yeah, I'm the one who's not, so blame.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry about that.
That.
What's up?
Well, if you're in the right location on the planet on March 9th or 8th, depending on your location, there's a total solar eclipse visible from parts of Indonesia and the Pacific Ocean, with a partial solar eclipse visible from Eastern Asia, much of Australia, and Hawaii. Check that out. If you're not there and not planning on traveling there, you can still check out the planets that are easy to see. Jupiter now coming up on its March 8th opposition, when it's on the opposite side of the Earth from the Sun. So it'll be rising around sunset and setting around dawn. And then Mars comes up around midnight in the east, and Saturn comes up a couple hours later. Venus is low in the eastern horizon in the pre-dawn. All right, we move on to this week in space history. In 1979, Voyager 1 flew past Jupiter. Yay! And 1 year ago, Dawn became the first spacecraft to orbit Ceres and the first spacecraft to orbit two bodies outside the Earth-Moon system, having already orbited Vesta.
Quite an accomplishment, something we will talk with Mark Raymond again about very soon. And now, of course, it's just flying, skimming the surface of that big object.
We move on to Random Space Fact.
I don't remember rhythm being a part of this in the past. I like it.
Just start introducing instruments. It's about time. In this case, the instrument was my desk. Just seemed appropriate, considering the day we're recording this, to say an Earth year is about 365 and a quarter days long, which is why we add a leap day to make up for that quarter.
And now and then a few more seconds?
We do. That's why you got the few seconds here, a few seconds there, the occasional 100 years where there's no leap day, but there are others where there is. So you got to tweak it, because it's not exactly 365 and a quarter, but it comes awfully close.
Seems kind of an embarrassment. You know, the aliens might want to make fun of us about, but okay, we just, maybe someday we'll go by star date or something like that. We're ready for the contest.
We asked you, what is the approximate peak wavelength of the sun's electromagnetic radiation, say, to the nearest 100 nanometers? How'd we do, Matt?
This one threw people a little bit. I think it held down the numbers a bit, though not much. Still had a very big response. And it was Melody Chan in British Columbia, who was chosen by Random.org as this week's winner. That is, if she got this right, she said the sun's peak wavelength is about 500 nanometers, and you only wanted it within about 100. So is close enough?
Yeah, close enough. I just wanted to, that's why I was shooting for 500 nanometers, so it's pretty approximately close.
Well then, Melody, congratulations. You are the winner of a Planetary Radio t-shirt, a 200-point iTelescope.net astronomy account, and I think this is the last week for a while, a set of those Year in Space wall and desk calendars from yearinspace.com. We will put those in the mail, get everything off to you very soon. Then we had people who talked about the color that 500 nanometers represents, and the plurality of people seemed to agree, as did Todd Yampole and Stephen Coulter. They described it in the same way. It's not that easy being green.
It's not indeed. So yeah, it peaks roughly in the green.
A few people thought it leaned more into the yellow. One of those, and this is becoming a weekly thing, although I can't promise that, Dave Fairchild in Shawnee, Kansas. He's the guy who's been sending us these little limericks and poems. Here's this week's. The answer to your question is 500, which is right, and that's the color yellow, though our sun is really white. The reason it looks yellow is our atmospheric haze, at least until it moves into its red gigantic stage. All right, so Dave, really got to send you a t-shirt, I guess. He has also done a poem, an epic poem, that you're in. You get a stanza, I get a stanza, Bill, Emily, Casey. We'll have to put that up on the website, maybe on the show page.
That's pretty cool. And you get a stanza, and you get a stanza.
Planetary.org/radio, where the show page is, and we'll post it there. I'll copy it over. It's pretty entertaining. So thank you, Dave. And congratulations, Melody. We're ready for the next one.
Who was the first person to do an EVA, an extra vehicular activity in space, in a spacesuit that did not have life support coming from an umbilical? Though there was a safety cord, safety umbilical, oxygen and the like was self-contained in the spacesuit. Who was the first person to do that? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
You have until the 8th, that'd be March 8th, Tuesday, March 8th, at 8 a.m. Pacific time to get us this answer. And if you're the winner, if you're chosen by random.org and have the right answer, you'll get an iTelescope.net account, access to that worldwide network of telescopes. Take some pictures, look at some stuff, anything you want, northern, southern hemisphere. You'll find them at iTelescope.net. And, of course, a Planetary Radio t-shirt. Everybody got my joke. Last show. Yes, my joke.
You're a funny man.
Yeah, when I said
it's all planned.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, everything's planned on this show. I said the deadline was February 30th, which, of course, doesn't exist in this universe as far as we know.
Leap day.
We got it right, though, this time.
Well, you know, it did exist back in the days of Julius Caesar before Augustus moved the days to August.
Oh, so that was in the Julian calendar, there was a 30-day February?
That is my understanding, and that Augustus was ticked off that July had more days, Julius July, than Augustus's August.
So we have one emperor to thank and one to feel bad for. And I think we're done.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and think about bleach. Thank you, and good night.
That's Bruce Betts, the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society, who knows that cleanliness is next to godliness. He joins us every week here for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its star-crossed members. Daniel Gunn is our associate producer. Josh Doyle created the theme music. I'm Matt Kaplan. Clear skies.